Time to check in once again with the State Senator John Keenan of Quincy for a kind of a Beacon Hill update, I guess, on what's going on at the State House and here in the district. John, good to virtually see you again.
It's great to see you again virtually. You know, hopefully, as we're saying, hopefully we'll get together back in the studio, see each other.
Absolutely. Is the Senate back in the building at all on Beacon Hill?
Not really. Sessions are being done mostly remotely. I've been going into the building and calling in from the office, or if I want to speak on the Senate floor, I'll go down into the chamber. But for the most part, members, we're doing it remotely, similar to what we're doing here. It seems to be working pretty well, but we don't have any certain guidance yet as to when staff will be back in the building. But we're just taking it day by day, but the sessions are proceeding with people there and with people remote.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about, I guess, the current situation with the pandemic, especially in the Norfolk Plymouth district, and how you kind of view it right now?
Yes. When we see what's going on in the rest of the country, it feels good. What we're doing here in Massachusetts and the Norfolk and Plymouth district is kind of representative of what's going on across the Commonwealth. So that's good news. Numbers continue to be as we'd like them to be. Some days they go up, some days they drop, but compared to where we were, we're in a much better shape. The key is to keep doing what we're doing, which is to stay distance and put masks on, make sure we wash our hands, all those things. And if we do that, hopefully we will continue to see these numbers as they are at worst and perhaps improve. But all it takes, we know, is somebody to come in from one of the hotspots somewhere else in the country, and that could all change pretty quickly. And so the state is working now to make sure that they have the PPE ready for what hopefully will not happen, but which may, which is a resurgence, and then also the resurgence and the combination of the seasonal flu. So we've got a lot of work ahead and a lot of time ahead of us to get through, but I'm optimistic that if we just keep doing the things we're supposed to do, we'll have it in decent control.
Do you think there should actually be a specific face mask law in Massachusetts?
I don't think there's a need for it right now. Massachusetts has had a pretty good record of compliance with the governor's executive orders and the directives relative to distancing and wearing masks. So I think if we continue to wear them when we're in public, when we go to stores, when we any chance that we're within 6 feet of somebody, I think that's the best way to go now. And people seem to be doing that. If people don't and we see the numbers rise, I guess we'll have to reassess. But right now, it seems to be working. And I think sometimes it works best, not with the hammer, but just kind of encouraging people to do the right thing. But again, all this could change, as we're seeing in many parts of the country.
Yeah, there's the recommended 14-day quarantine for folks coming from some of those hotspots. Does that need more teeth, do you think, to make sure that they are complying?
It's the same thing. You know, you can say that it's absolutely required, but how do you enforce something like that? So I think education, outreach, advisories, all those things are a better approach. But we'll see what happens. And if things continue to trend as they are, then that should be enough. If there's any sort of a turn and the trend is in the opposite direction, then we'll have to reassess all these things.
Yeah. What is the current status of unemployment in Massachusetts?
The numbers are still quite high. The unemployment numbers for the country came out yesterday. It was an increase in the number of individuals, not yesterday, but this past week, an increase in the number of individuals seeking unemployment. In our office, we still are getting calls relative to unemployment, and there's been a little bit of an uptick on that, I'd say, in the last 7 to 10 days. And we may see more people going back to work now that the federal benefits are set to expire. Employees maybe more willing to go back. It's still that risk assessment that they do. Do they want to go back? Risk exposure, but the numbers are pretty good. And so there may be a financial need to go back, and that need may be met with a climate that's pretty good right now. So, but unemployment is still incredibly high, and it's having a pretty significant impact on our state budget.
You know, the governor had mentioned not too long ago some of the scams involved with the unemployment system. Is there any improvement on that front that you've heard of?
The state is proceeding very cautiously. what has happened with the scam is that people who have had their information stolen previously through one of the big company breaches or something of that nature, credit card breach, that information is out there and available to people who want to scam individuals, or in this case, the government. And there was an alarming increase in the number of people saying that their information was being used. And so that has slowed down the state's process in getting benefits to people because they are being very careful and they've added an additional layer of identification required to get the benefits. And so it has had an impact, but the state is responding to it, and hopefully we'll see those claims of scams decrease.
Sure. While we're talking about money, what's the current status of the state budget, John?
Not good.
Yeah.
We still do not have a state budget for fiscal year 2021, which we are now in. We are wrapping up fiscal year 2020. We don't have final numbers yet. It will be a while before we have final numbers, but there's estimates that we may be somewhere about $700-800 million in deficit for fiscal year 2020. So we will have to rely on federal funds to close that gap or use funds that are in our rainy day account. For fiscal year 2021, we're in a basically approaching a second interim budget, which is kind of a bare bones level funded budget from last year. We are waiting to see what the federal government does. The projections for fiscal year 2021, as far as a decrease in state revenues, is between $6 and $8 billion. Hmm. So the governor submitted his budget in January based on an agreed upon revenue figure. Since that number was determined, there has been a decrease in that estimate by about $6 to $8 billion. So it's really going to depend on what we get from the federal government. And the bigger concern is going into fiscal year 2022, because there's just so much uncertainty. We might be able to plug some holes with our rainy day account with some federal money, but if we use both of those things for fiscal year 2021, it leaves us exposed for fiscal year 2022 if the economy doesn't come back in some form, of some very strong form.
Yeah, and speaking with like the mayor here in Quincy and some other town officials, they're concerned about how that would impact their local aid figures, their education aid figures from the state. Obviously, there are no answers right now to those, right?
There are no answers right now. We're recommending that they look back at what happened 2008, 2009, and use that as a bit of a guidepost as to how they plan their budgets. The city, it's been reported what the city has spent related to COVID, and there are some projections that they'll get a significant amount of that back from the federal government, but everybody is still waiting.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about going back to school in the fall? That's kind of like the really pressing issue right now. It all hinges, obviously, on the pandemic situation status, if you will. What do you think about the state guidelines for going back to school?
I think the state guidelines are just that, they're guidelines. And I've heard from some of the school departments that they have some concerns about what they'll be able to implement, whether they'll be able to afford some of the things that they want to do. And so it's still, as with the state budget, it's one of those things that's still a work in progress. Most of the school systems now are developing alternative plans. One is to go back to school and to make sure that you do distancing within the classrooms and mask wearing and offering additional wash stations and things like that. The other is to have remote education. And then the third is a hybrid, that perhaps some students will be in school for a number of days, and then another group of students will come in for a different number of days, and they'll trade off in classroom and remote learning. All of that is still being worked on. It's going to be number driven, and it's going to be driven by updated guidance in terms of what is going to work best. Some schools are wrestling with whether to do temperature checks for every student or not do temperature checks. So there's a lot of discussion still ongoing, and the return to school is coming up very quickly. So decisions will have to be made, and we'll see where they lead. But it's clearly a cause of concern, but we can't underestimate how important it is for students to get back. But we have to be cautious so that we don't contribute to a sudden or substantial resurgence of COVID-19.
Does any plan need approval by teachers unions, either by the state or local teachers unions?
I'm not so sure they need approval, but I know that the communities have been working with the teachers.
Yeah.
And one of the concerns that teachers have is that if each district does something differently, if one district is different from the next, a teacher may live in one town and work in another town. The town where the teacher works may only be doing remote learning, and that teacher then may have childcare responsibilities at home and be unable to work. So those are the types of things that, again, that are being worked out. And the teachers union have expressed that as a concern, and have expressed a concern that while the spread among young people, particularly very young children, is unknown, the degree to which they spread it, there's no real pure scientific conclusion on that yet. They're concerned that, you know, they'll be exposed and they'll bring it home to loved ones, and that will create problems. So still a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah, I've heard concerns too about a disparity in learning if there are individual plans within communities. You know, right now, all the kids are kind of on the same playing field in the public schools here in the state, but that could splinter, you know, with some kids maybe getting a different type of education than others.
Yeah, and that comes back to what local communities can afford to fund.
Right.
You know, Quincy took the step and made sure that students had Chromebooks, had access to computers. Some communities can't do that.
Right.
Some communities in Massachusetts still do not have reliable access to the internet,
yep,
Wi-Fi, and that is a concern. So each community is facing a different set of challenges, which is something that will be worked through over the next few months. And it's certainly going to be a learning experience once the students go back to school, and as we progress through the school seasons.
Sure. We talk a little bit, John, about the police reform bill. It's kind of the big white elephant in the room that we're dancing around. It did pass in the Senate, and it passed in a controversial fashion, I guess I would say. Let me ask you, first of all, just kind of your overall feeling about that bill.
There is much to be commended in the bill, and there are some things of concern in the bill. Things that to be commended. We do not have a uniform hiring process for police officers here in Massachusetts. This bill moves the Commonwealth towards having a standardized hiring system. We do not have standardized training within our police academies. It's similar, pretty close, but not the same. This would move to a standardization of police officer training. For those who are already on the job that are required to get 40 hours of in-service training, we have many departments in the Commonwealth where officers are not getting their in-service training. And that was a result, we have that information as a result of an audit that was done by Auditor Bump. So we know that some departments, they're not getting the required 40 hours, and we know there may be as many as 9 or 10 departments where they're not getting any in-service training. So this legislation would standardize that process and have the reporting to a central group, which I can touch on, so that they will be able to monitor who has gotten that training and who hasn't. We do not have standardized use of force policies in the Commonwealth. This would move towards that. We do not have any sort of standardized officer reporting of use of excessive force in the Commonwealth. This would establish that. We do not have many of our departments in the Commonwealth accredited. There are about 100, maybe between 100 and 115 departments in Massachusetts that are either accredited or certified. This would put in motion put a path in place towards accreditation of our police departments. And we do not have or give the Attorney General of Massachusetts the ability to do pattern or practice reviews of departments. This would allow for that as well. We do not have any sort of standardized data collection. We do with the hands-free law, but this would address some of that as well. So those are the good things. The big issue that came up is the issue of qualified immunity, which protects public employees, including police officers. And there was an attempt in the Senate bill to not abolish it. It is not abolished, and there's been a big misunderstanding about that. Qualified immunity is not abolished in the Senate version of the bill. The Senate attempted with language to address those cases where everybody would agree that a police officer should not get qualified immunity, meaning should not be automatically dismissed from a lawsuit because they happen to be a public employee. So we're trying to get to the cases where the conduct is so egregious and so obviously beyond the scope of what a police officer should be doing, that the qualified immunity would not automatically attach. That's what we were trying to do. I'm not sure the Senate version got the language as clear as it could be. So I joined with 16 other senators to try to get that issue, qualified immunity, removed from the bill, send it to a panel of experts, have them come back with the language that matches the intent of what we were trying to do. but we were unsuccessful. There's 16 of us who tried. There is, I think, a concern about an impact on collective bargaining rights. I raised that on the Senate floor. I was joined by my colleague, Senator Mark Pacheco. We spoke on the Senate floor. Ultimately, there was a compromise that gives better protection to collectively bargain rights to grievance. And so that was in the bill. The amendment was in the bill. But there's still, we want to make sure that collectively bargain rights are recognized and preserved. So there are some really good things in the bill. There are some things that need additional work. And in totality of reviewing those, I thought that it was more good than there was bad, and that it warranted being moved to the next step. And that's where it is now. As we speak today, on Friday, it is in the House of Representatives being debated. They will produce a bill, and to the extent their bill is different than ours, a conference committee will be formed, and they will work out the differences. They'll present a consensus bill that will be presented to the House and the Senate for an up or down vote. And if it passes in both branches, then it goes to the governor. And I will, one, make sure that we have time to review that bill, and two, to make sure that it reflects more good than bad. And hopefully, at the time the process has been completed, those things of concern will have been addressed. And so I'll see how that looks before making my final decision on whether to vote to send it to the governor.
Much was made about the manner in which the Senate passed the bill late on a Sunday night without a public hearing. How do you feel about that?
I felt, and I expressed this, I felt that it was not a good process. It was not a good process. It was a 72-page bill, and I have a process that I follow in reviewing legislation. Usually amendments to bills are due on Tuesday, and so Sunday night is the time I set aside, usually between 9:30 at night to literally to 2 in the morning, where I review the legislation. I redline it with recommendations for amendments or with questions. I review it with the folks in the office on Monday, and then we prepare our amendments. We did that here, but we were certainly rushed. And then the session that we had was scheduled for a Thursday. It was objected to by Republican Ryan Fatman. On Friday, I joined him in objecting to the process, trying to get at least a couple more days to talk to different people. And I used that time to talk to police chiefs, Boston Police Patrol Officers Association, state police with the NAACP, the ACLU. We're on a conference call of about 20 people to try to address at least the qualified immunity language. And then it went to the Senate floor. Our ability to stop it any further was exhausted. We took up the bill, and unfortunately, it took many hours to get through the bill, and we voted on it in the morning. There was some criticism about there not being a public hearing on the bill, and that's justified. However, the process that the committee, there was a committee that wrote this bill. The process that they used was to take bills that had worked their way through the legislative process and to include them in the bill. So this became kind of a combination of different pieces of legislation. For instance, on qualified immunity, there had been a hearing back in September on the qualified immunity piece of the bill. There had been a hearing on bills relating to setting up the POSAC, which is a police kind of oversight committee. That had been subject to hearings back in July of 2019. So a lot of the pieces had hearings, the bill itself didn't. And it would have been obviously good to have a hearing on the bill itself.
So a lot of folks have asked me, what's the rush? You know, why the expedited process?
There's a couple things driving that. One is the context of the times in which we live. Mm-hmm. There was an impetus, this committee that wrote the legislation was formed right after the George Floyd situation. And so that was the impetus for forming the committee. And then the committee was mindful of the legislative calendar, where our legislative session goes through the end of December into next January. The formal sessions, where bigger bills, more controversial bills are taken up, typically ends on July 31st. And so they looked at that as a deadline. And that's those two things kind of what contributed to trying to move this as quickly as possible. And it has been a fast-track piece of legislation. Again, there's a lot of work that's done throughout the course of the legislative session on parts of it, mm-hmm. but it is moving quickly, and we'll see what the final product looks like.
Some of the concerns I've heard, I talk to folks in law enforcement every single day. A couple of things there. Obviously, they're concerned about the qualified immunity provision and whether or not that would prohibit people from getting into law enforcement in the first place, or force folks to get out of it. And number two, a concern about social workers taking over where law enforcement might be needed, and that leading to both, you know, litigation issues as well as personal safety issues.
Yeah, so on the qualified immunity, police officers are taught and are trained to use, to act reasonably and proportionately to the circumstances. That's always been pretty much the standard. And this doesn't change that standard. I can give you just a quick example. For instance, this is a case, and I can get to the more detailed facts, but the case basically is that there's an individual in a surrender position on his knees, his arms are raised in the air. There is a dog circling the individual, and there's an officer there who has a weapon. And the individual asks the officer, you know, I'm surrendering, please don't have the dog attack me. This is not in Quincy. We thankfully, these things, you know, our dog officers are, I think, the best in the state. But in any event, the officer confronted with an individual on his knees with his arms raised saying, please don't have the dog attack me, has the dog attack him. Mm. And that officer who acted contrary to his training, who acted purposely, recklessly, apparently to inflict harm, was covered by qualified immunity. And those cases aren't all that common, but they do occur. And so the intent of the legislature was to address those types of cases. And for those who have always done their job, using their best judgment and using reacting reasonably given all the circumstances, they have been protected by qualified immunity, and they will be protected by qualified immunity if the Senate language becomes the final language and they clear up, I think, to make the language clearer than what it is. The qualified immunity doctrine has developed over the years in the court, and it is designed to protect public employees from frivolous lawsuits when they make a mistake. It doesn't prevent lawsuits from being filed. It allows public employees to be dismissed from the lawsuit because they made a mistake and they acted reasonably and proportionately to the circumstances. That's why it was designed. And the way it's been applied over the years is there's this funky standard of whether there's an established law on the matter. And if the law is not clearly established, then somebody gets it automatically. So in that dog case, there really hadn't been a case like that before. So it hadn't been clearly established. Mm. That officer got qualified immunity. And we're saying, yeah, it may not have been clearly established because it had never been brought up in the courts, but everybody would agree that that behavior was not something that should get a police officer out of a lawsuit. Now that police officer still has due process, will go through civil due process, will still go through that litigation, and will still be subject to a trial and then a jury deciding whether the officer acted reasonably and proportionately.
Okay.
But just that officer in that case was able to get out of the lawsuit right at the beginning because it hadn't been addressed before.
Okay.
And that's what we were trying to address. Now, whether that has an impact on attracting people to law enforcement, you know, the climate now is and it's always been a very, very difficult job, mm-hmm. increasingly difficult job in this environment. And I think that will deter people from joining law enforcement. Whether this legislation itself does, I think depends on how well the public and police officers and public employees are educated on any changes to the qualified immunity statute. And if they are educated by their attorneys, meaning the union attorneys and the leadership within police departments, they'll know that as long as they do their job, they're going to be covered when they make a mistake. And that shouldn't impact people joining law enforcement. And my intent in as I looked at the bill was, does this move law enforcement forward? And I think if you have standardized use of force policy, standardized hiring, standardized training, standardized education, require officers to report uses of excessive force by fellow officers, ultimately we'll have law enforcement where people will feel more certain coming in as to what's expected of them. And I think that will help attract people back to law enforcement. Mm-hmm. During this period of, you know, it seems like the world is upside down. And I know that law enforcement officers are feeling the brunt of that. Right. And I understand that and I respect that. And you know, so many of them I know, and they're my friends. So it was difficult knowing that the climate that they're working in to vote on this legislation. But I'm trying to do what's best for all the people of the Commonwealth. And then also, you know, I think hopefully in the long term, it'll be shown that the improvements to the law enforcement that could come of this bill will be good.
Will this bill impact state police also, John?
Yes. So there are some, the state police will be subject basically to all of the same things. And there are some reforms that are specific to state police within the bill, because we had a state police department, and not everybody in the department, but clearly a lot of people within that department were committing fraud mm-hmm. for a long period of time. And it just went unchecked. And so the hope is that through the accreditation process and those types of things, that we'll start to pick that up, and then we'll change the culture. And I know that some police officers aren't happy when I mention this, but we do have a situation out in Springfield, Mass, where that department is under the Department of Justice review, and the Department of Justice released their report last week talking about the excessive use of force within the narcotics unit of that department, and that it's gone on for a long time. And people say, well, you know, are we overreacting to what happened in Minneapolis? We are reacting to that, but we have issues here in Massachusetts. I firmly believe we have the best law enforcement in the country, the best educated officers. They do overall get the best training. I think we're particularly fortunate in the areas that I represent, and in Boston, I think is one of the best big city police departments in the country. But we can't rest on our laurels. We have to recognize that not every officer is getting in-service training, not every department is accredited, that we do have issues in state police that were long-standing. We do have issues in other police departments like Springfield that are long-standing, and those have to be addressed.
How about, does this also include MBTA police, environmental police, the sheriff's departments?
Yes. The sheriff's departments, to the extent that if they go out and do details and so forth, they will be covered. And there was some concern that law enforcement wouldn't be involved in the regulations that will be drafted as a result of the legislation. Again, I say all this with a big if, mm-hmm. if it ultimately passes. But there are on the committee that will license police officers, I think there's only four states, or maybe I think there's 40 states in the country that have this kind of licensing process where they have this post committee. And there's a lot of concern that police officers wouldn't be on that committee. The House of Representatives is working on a bill that has a different version of the committee, but the Senate version had representatives from the state police, from the MBTA police, from Boston police, from the Mass Chiefs Association, an officer of rank of sergeant down, somebody from the minority law enforcement. So all those, there is a substantial representation on that committee that will license, de-license police officers, and that will work to establish a lot of these regulations.
How about any civilian representation? Has that been considered at all?
Yes, there is civilian representation. There's a total of 13 on the Senate proposed board.
Okay.
And I believe five or six of those are law enforcement, and the rest come from, you know, other appointments, NAACP, ACLU, and other community and other groups.
Yep.
So it's a mix. And people said, well, other boards, teachers, doctors, and lawyers, they all oversee each other. Well, teachers, I don't know if there is a teacher on the licensing board for teachers. For lawyers, there are civilians on that board, the Board of Bar Overseers. The Board of Registration and Medicine, there are civilians. And so there are civilians on this board that will license police officers as well. The idea of the licensing is make sure that they get the training they're supposed to get. They'll get their license renewed. But if they don't, or if there's some issue that results in them losing their license, they won't be able to go to a neighboring town. They won't be able to go to a neighboring state and become a police officer. There is a federal database right now, a national database, where all this information in Massachusetts would become part of that.
So are these paid appointments, or how will they actually be appointed?
They are nominated through state police, Boston police, and through the different organizations. Ultimately, most of them are appointed by the governor. I believe there's a stipend, but I'll have to double check on that because there was some amendments that had to do with that, and the House is working on that as well. So ultimately, we'll see how that works. But there'd be an executive director of the committee and so forth, and so it would be a professional organization.
Okay. going forward, John, in the current session, what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, we're working on a few things. One, obviously, we're going to monitor police reform very closely. Our hope was that there'd be some sort of healthcare legislation. It's uncertain whether that'll make its way through the House and the Senate. We've been working on legislation that would provide protections to people who struggle with MS, protection from having their medication changed because of increase in copays or dropping off a formulary of a particular insurance company. It's critical that they continue to have access for that medication. We are closely monitoring the budget situation because obviously we want to make sure that resources are there for Quincy and the other towns in my district, Rockland, Abington, Holbrook, and Braintree, make sure they have the resources they need. So it's going to be a busy next week as we go towards the end of the session. And it's still unknown whether we will extend the session beyond January 31st.
Oh, interesting. Okay. You did approve the alcohol to-go bill, though, to help restaurants a bit.
Yes. Yeah. Given the circumstances, I ordinarily wouldn't be in favor of that, but given the circumstances, it's something that restaurant owners were asking for. It will last as long as the declared state of emergency. There are some controls in place for it. It will help their takeout business. And so I think it was a good move. We've also had legislation that allows restaurants to provide outdoor dining and alcohol service at their outdoor patios or venues in Quincy, for instance, on Cottage Ave. Mm-hmm. They do it out there. So it will streamline that process, even though many communities are already doing it. So we're trying to respond to the unique challenges of the pandemic and trying to help businesses as best we can.
Yeah. Right. Anything else to touch on today?
No, it's just, it's challenging times. And, you know, the police reform bill and a lot of the other legislation that is coming before us is highlighting that the difficult times for people. And people have heightened levels of anxiety, there's no doubt. And people are moving towards extremes. And it's my hope that we continue efforts to bring people together, that we just don't settle on yes, no, up, down, left, right, that we have dialogue, that we have discussion, that we bring people to the table and continue to move things forward rather than just swinging back and forth with nothing getting done. The times demand us to do that, and I hope we continue to make efforts to bring people together.
Yeah. How do folks reach out to you, John, especially during this time? What's some good ways?
The best way to do it is 617-722-1494. That's the office number. Or they can send an email to john.keenan@masenate.gov. Those are the two best ways to get in touch with the office. We're working remotely, but it's been pretty seamless. We're in constant contact. The only thing that we don't get to do is see each other in person. But other than that, the contact is still the same. And I just want to say thank you, too. These are very challenging times, and people are upset. And I have to say that the folks that work in my office, they are top-notch. They're doing incredible work for the people that we all, me and my team represent, in very challenging times. They're working really hard. They're doing great things. They're helping people with their unemployment benefits and registry of motor vehicle issues, you name it. We're getting those calls, and we're responding as best we can. And we're even getting calls from some other districts because somebody in our district will have a relative in another district and say, oh, we got a good response here. And so people are calling, and we're happy to help out as many people as we can. We're not advertising for additional business.
Right.
I just want to say to the people of Quincy and the rest of my district, there's a great team working on your behalf, and I'm proud to be part of that team.
All right. Well, good to talk to you. Good to virtually see you. I said this before, but I'll say it again. Hopefully it can be in person next time. Right.
Let's hope.
Thanks very much, John.
Thank you, Joe. Be well.
You too.
Thanks.